and then from book seven. Looking ahead to Thursday, I want to start with our next author on Thursday. It's Aristotle. And Aristotle is another encyclopedia, and we could easily spend the rest of our semester talking about him, but we just have a reading from one work of his in the course pack, a work entitled Metaphysics, so I'd like to get to that on Thursday. Also, you should all have received an Avenue System email telling you that the new writing assignment, the first writing assignment, is posted on Avenue and available there for you to start working on. So we're making a kind of a transition now from Plato to Socrates. Now, of course, it's all been Plato. Everything we've been reading has been written by Plato. I mentioned to you that Socrates, so far as we know, never actually wrote anything. Scholars are a little bit unsure about how to understand the relation between Socrates and Plato. Is the Socrates that we see in these dialogues, is that just Plato showing us the way the man was? Or is it just a mouthpiece for Plato's ideas? It's hard to be sure. But all the dialogues we've looked at to this point are ones that scholars generally think of as being relatively early in Plato's writing career, and therefore are possibly a better indication of what a conversation with Socrates might have been like. But when we turn to the Republic, that's going to change. Now Socrates just becomes a mouthpiece for Plato's ideas. Socrates loses his former reluctance to theorize, and he becomes a vehicle for Plato to advance ideas that he wishes to defend. Republic is Plato's most famous work, and we're going to be looking just at a small part of it where he tells us about what he calls the idea of the good. Plato took a very consequential step in metaphysics. Metaphysics is just a word that we use, a bit of technical jargon in philosophy, for a philosophical theory of being, or reality. Plato's big step in metaphysics is to explain being as idea. To be, that's to be an idea. Only an idea truly is, in a completely unqualified sense. Anything other than an idea, like a material body, sense perception, any other things are, have being, have reality, only insofar as they express or make visible an idea. Now, idea, in this context, obviously idea doesn't mean your opinion. I had an idea about what we could do. Obviously, the word has changed, but this now is the original sense of this word that has gone through a lot of history that brings us up to our present time. But in Plato, idea means ideal form. Contrary to the way we use language, in Plato, an idea is the most objective thing there could possibly be. It is the very substance of reality. An idea now means ideal form. Ideal, that means perfect. Hence, never encountered in bodies or known through the senses. A perfect triangle, a perfectly straight line. Ideas are intelligible, not sensible. Intelligible is the opposite of sensible or sense perceptible. Sensible things are things that the senses know. Intelligibles are things that we rationally understand, like perfectly straight line or perfect triangle. True reality in Plato's picture is completely different from the way almost everybody thinks of it, the way that we spontaneously imagine what common sense tells us. True reality, what really substantially is a world of these ideas. Immaterial, changeless, thoroughly rational order. The true world is a spiritual world. Immaterial and changeless, eternal. Think of Socrates again in that painting by David on our course path, pointing up to heaven, toward the ideas, toward the ideal, and saying that if you believe in that, then this death that you're about to see, it has no reality. The impressions that we have from the senses all the sights and sounds and smells that engross us, those are not ideas. They are the appearance of ideas, copies of ideas, rather than the ideas themselves. And what's more, they're bad, unreliable, inaccurate copies. You're never going to see in ordinary vision with your real physical eyes, you're never going to see a perfect triangle. But that doesn't impede your understanding at all. You understand the idea perfectly. The idea is intelligible, not sensible. It doesn't depend on your eyes. Closed three-sided figure. What more do you need? What do you need to see or touch or inspect? Closed three-sided figure. That is the idea that makes every triangle a triangle. It's the form that's repeated in every triangle that there is. For Plato, that form is finer, more noble and beautiful, and truer, more veritably real and in being than any material body ever could be. Now, of course, triangle is a simple example, but the theory is that there would be ideas for all the properties and kinds in nature. And additionally, there's an idea of the good, the form that all good things share and which makes them to be good. Well, the first point that Plato makes in the passage that we're reading from Book 6 of the Republic is that this idea of the good is the most important thing that anyone could possibly know. And that's because it's only by conforming to this idea of the good that anything else is made useful or beneficial for us. If you don't know the idea of the good, then you don't know how to use anything else well. No matter what else we know, no matter how much we know, if we don't know the idea of the good, then all that other knowledge cannot benefit us. To attain knowledge of the good, that's the aspiration of Plato's philosophy. Wisdom will be an intellectual insight into the reason that makes anything really good. Now, Plato thinks, like Socrates did, that every one of us naturally aspires to philosophical knowledge of the good. Not just the philosophers are alone in loving such knowledge. Nobody is satisfied with what's merely believed to be good. Everybody wants what is good, what's really good. They may be wrong in what they think that is, but if you can convince someone that something they think is good isn't good, then automatically they no longer want it. So Plato says, every soul pursues the good and does whatever it does for its sake. To know what is good for ourselves, we have to know the best state of all things. We can't understand our own good without understanding how it integrates with the best state of everything else, because all things get interconnected, so nothing is really isolated and separate. If you're going to understand how can I really pursue what's good for me, you have to know, this is Plato's thought, you have to know all that interconnection. And that means that there's always a linkage. It may be obscure. It may take some thought and inquiry to puzzle it out. But all those good things are all interconnected. And ultimately, there's no distinction between what's good for you and what's good for the city, your neighbor, everybody, what's good in itself. Once you appreciate that, then Plato thinks you're going to want to make a commitment to philosophy, because you're going to realize that you're never going to be happy until you can really understand this idea of the good. And once you do make that commitment to philosophy, as a way of life and a method of inquiry, then it's going to become, or at least this is what Plato expects, become increasingly difficult to tolerate the thoughtless opinions of others that satisfy themselves with mere opinions. How can somebody be satisfied with opinion when knowledge is there to be found? Now, when I say opinion, I'm referring to the Greek word I put up here, doxa. Sometimes it's translated opinion, sometimes belief. And I'll use those two terms completely interchangeably. So opinion, belief, it's just different English for the same Greek, doxa. You glimpse the idea of the good, and opinion is going to increasingly seem to you to be deformed, ugly, even shameful. Plato, in our reading, makes Socrates say, opinions without knowledge are shameful, ugly things. Why would somebody have opinions about triumph? Why would somebody have beliefs about a perfectly straight line? Imagine somebody saying, in my opinion, there may be some four-sided triangles. I mean, we haven't drawn them yet or even thought of them, but it seems logical that probably there are some, in my opinion. Who cares for such opinions? Either you know it and you prove it, or shut up. Opinion is shameful because it's not a passive thing that we just innocently find ourselves with, or that just innocently occurs to a person. That's not the way opinion or belief works. We don't innocently find ourselves stocked with a bunch of opinions, but we take an active, culpable part in cultivating our opinions. The truly passive element in belief is perception. But perception by itself is not belief. Animals don't have beliefs, animals don't have opinions, but they definitely have perceptions. So you've got to add something to that perception before it becomes an opinion or a belief. Opinion comes when we judge a perception, when we say, yes, that's true, or yes, that's good. Now that's why Plato thinks we should be ashamed of having opinions at all. We should either know or know that we don't know, but having a belief, having an opinion, that's good for knowing. A philosophical knowledge of the good is not opinion. It's not belief. It's scientific knowledge of the truth. And with that kind of knowledge, one knows how to use everything in the optimal way. One can direct all things to their best usage. Once you buy that much of Plato's theory, then it seems logical to just go a step further and think that those kind of people, the ones that have that knowledge, they really ought to be in charge of the government. The kings, they should be philosophers. And the philosophers, they should be the kings. There's a criticism of democracy that's implied in Plato's evaluation of knowledge versus opinion. The philosophers, at least Plato's philosophers, they're not friends of democracy. Democracy needs opinion. Democracy lives on opinion. It depends on the exchange of opinion. Public discourse, conversation, the occasion for a democratic public opinion to emerge through people exchanging their beliefs and discussions. The philosophers, the Platonic philosophers, they're impatient with all that talk. All that, my belief, my opinion, what's your opinion, impatient with that kind of stuff. And you can understand why. I mean, if you've got a few wise men who really know for sure the truth about the best things in the world, then how can they be expected to care for a democratic opinion? The philosophers, possessing true knowledge, have no tolerance for those who are stuck in opinion. Opinion shouldn't be listened to, it should not be respected or accommodated, it should be suppressed. Differences of opinion should be suppressed. When Socrates says, back in the Apology, addressing those men who thought they were harming him while killing him, when he says to them, the unexamined life, it's just not worth living. When he says that, he's expressing his low opinion of opinion. Why should life be examined? To identify what's mere opinion and therefore unworthy of a philosophical mind. Examine yourself relentlessly. Never let opinion take root in your mind. Try to know the truth, but above all, know when you do not know. Know when you don't know. And never confuse opinion with knowledge. Now, opinions can be true. The problem with opinion is not that they're necessarily false. They can be true. It's not falsity that makes opinion shameful. True opinion is like a blind person accidentally finding the right road. The difference between knowledge and opinion is the difference between understanding and not understanding. You can have a true opinion without having any idea about why it happens to be true. It's just, Plato would say, you're just lucky. Understanding, of course, that's our word. That's modern English. Plato's word, which was also the word that Parmenides used in exactly the sense, is nous. And nous means intellectual mind, the mind of logic and reason, rather than feeling or desire. Still in Book 6, in the short passage that we have from Book 6, Plato develops the idea of the understanding with a famous analogy, which I put up here on this overhead. The sun is to visible things and to the power of sight the same way that the idea of the good is to intelligible things and to the power of understanding. The sun illuminates visible things and enables us to see them. And in the same way, or analogously, the idea of the good illuminates invisible, intelligible things, and enables us to understand them. Plato explains this idea of the good as being at one at the same time the cause of being for ideas. It causes ideas to be. And it also causes understanding in the mind. The same one idea of the good causes all the other ideas to exist or be or have reality. And it causes understanding in the mind. So that makes this one idea, the idea of the good, quite special, a singular idea that rises above all the other ideas. The idea of the good, it's not just one more idea, the idea of justice, the idea of snow, the idea of the good. It's not just one more with all the others. It's not just one more entity in reality, but it's the transcendent cause of all that is real. The idea of the good contains all the other ideas virtually. The way that the color white, or white light, contains all other colors virtually. This idea of the good, Plato calls it beyond being, transcendent, the condition that makes ideas to be and makes minds to understand. Now, understanding, that means knowing, knowledge in the strict and philosophical sense. To understand is to focus the intellect on a form, on an idea, and that's not easy to do. It's like being able to stare into the sun and not be blinded. When you understand an idea, you understand true being, what truly is and never changes. And that's what knowledge is. Plato says it here in our text. He says, knowledge knows how what is. Knowledge knows what is as it is. Now, the criterion for this kind of knowledge, the way that you know that it's knowledge, the sign or the test by which we know knowledge to be knowledge, is infallibility. When we truly know something, it's completely impossible that we should be wrong. Opinion lacks this kind of infallibility. It's not, opinion is not brilliantly clear and distinct. Opinion is dim. The ideas are obscured by fog. The fog that arises from matter, from the senses, from the body. Knowledge and opinion are completely different. There's no continuity at all. The object of knowledge is that which is completely being. The object of belief mixes what is with what is not. Knowledge is inerrant, infallible. Belief is always fallible and quite often outright false. People that are stuck with opinions, people that are living whose minds are occupied with belief only, they believe that justice, say, or beauty are qualities of particular things. Those with philosophical knowledge understand that justice and beauty are themselves entities, pure ideas, not on the same level at all with the bodies that show those qualities to the senses. In Plato, we have a hierarchy of the mind, the contents of the mind, the bottom part of my overhead here. The highest aspiration of the mind is understanding, nous, and to have that is the same as to be a master of philosophy. Below that, there's what Plato calls thought. That belongs to science. And then there's perception. And that's where ordinary people with belief or opinion are stuck. Now, Plato explains this difference between science and philosophy. By science, what he means especially is mathematics, and any other science insofar as it is mathematical. What to Plato is distinctive about science, in contrast to philosophy, what's distinctive about science is its reliance on hypotheses. Any science is to some degree hypothetical. It begins with hypotheses, works out the implications, tests them for truth, goes back for more implications, tests those for truth. Now that's obviously a good thing. Rational inquiry. But it's not knowledge in that strict and philosophical sense that Plato so admires. It's not nous. It's not intellectual understanding. It's near to it, but it's not yet it. And that's what Plato calls thought, or in his words, his word for that is dianoia. Thought and science lie halfway between opinion and understanding, or philosophy, right in the middle. Science thinks, and that's way better than opinion, but it doesn't yet understand, so it's not yet philosophy. The problem with science is those hypotheses. They are the first principles of any science, and yet they remain hypothetical, and so to some degree, arbitrary and unknown or unexplained. No science can explain its own first principles. Instead, those principles are how the science goes about explaining all the other things that it can explain. You stop being a scientist and take the step into philosophy when you are no longer satisfied with inexplicable hypotheses or hypothetical thought. You want truth. So how can we do away with hypotheses? How can we enjoy knowledge without any kind of presupposition, whatever? Plato says there's a special method. It's the last point on my list of keywords. Plato says there's a special method. He calls it dialectic. And he explains dialectic as an inquiry that systematically attempts to grasp, with respect to each thing itself, what the being of it is. Dialectic attempts to grasp for anything that we're inquiring dialectically into, it'll be saying, what in here is real being? That is, what's the idea here? Dialectic does away with presuppositions. It overcomes everything that's hypothetical in thought, and it leads to presuppositionless knowing. At least that's the theory. And of course, it sounds great. Who wouldn't like to have presuppositionless knowledge? But Plato, unfortunately, tells us very little about exactly how dialectic works. The only examples that he gives us are the conversations that we see with Socrates. In those conversations with Socrates, we see dialectic as a process of eliciting the truth by means of question. Socrates never makes hypotheses. There's absolutely nothing hypothetical in his thought, and no presuppositions either, because he never does anything except ask questions. The questions aim at uncovering something that people already know. And if there's some contradiction or some muddle in people's thinking, then dialectic will uncover and expose that also. Now, every time Socrates actually tries this method, all that he ever uncovers is just other people's muddle and confusion. He never quite gets to the idea. But Plato seems to think that if dialectic could be practiced in a more disciplined way, then it would be a method for arriving at presuppositionless knowledge. Good. I want to talk now about the second part of our reading from the Republic, which comes from the next book in the Republic, book 7. And here I want to talk about probably Plato's most famous notion, and that is what's called the allegory of the cave. Let me tell you a little bit about this story. So here's I hope you can make out what this is. This is a story that Plato tells, Socrates tells, his disciples that are gathered around him. He says, I'm going to tell you a story, just a story, just an allegory, a parable. I'm not saying it's really true, but it shows us something true, helps us to understand something. So suppose there's this cave, deep down under the earth. Down in this cave live a whole society. And this society, like modern Astors and the slaves. The slaves down in this society, they're in a terrible condition. They're all so arranged. This is somewhat far-fetched, so just let me have all these crazy assumptions. That's the way Plato tells the story. These slaves, they're all chained up in such a way that all they can see is just in front of them. And their eyes, their head, is facing blank wall of the cave. So all they see their whole life is just this wall of this cave. They can never move around. Now back behind them is a great fire. And in the space between the fire and the slaves, but still back behind them where they can't see what's going on, that's where the masters live and where the masters move. And the masters have made all these big cutouts, like they make a bird out of plaster of Paris, or a cardboard bird or a cardboard tree. And they take these and they march with these things in the space between the fire and behind the slaves, and that casts a shadow on the wall. And that's all the slaves ever see. Their whole life, from birth to death, all they ever actually see are these shadows of these artificially manufactured things that the masters contrive to have projected onto the wall. Now, of course, the slaves don't know shadows. From the slaves' point of view, that's reality. That's the way things are. And they even have a kind of a slave shadow cave science, where they make up all kinds of laws. Well, when you see this kind of shadow, you're probably going to see this kind of shadow next. Or this kind of shadow gives rise to that kind of shadow. And they think they're so smart, and they even are proud of their science, they call it. Their laws of nature, really just laws of shadows. Well, suppose that one of these slaves, we never learn how this could happen, we just play with this process. He says, suppose that one of these slaves, he wiggles free. He's able to turn around. For the first time in his life, he turns around and he sees that fire. Never seen anything so bright. Never had any idea that there could be anything so colorful and moving and alive. And then this slave wiggles free a little bit more and is able to escape from his bonds and sees that there's a route out, sees some even brighter light, a bit of sunlight way up at the end where this cave would open up onto the sky. And this slave starts struggling to climb up there. Of course, he can hardly see because his eyes are totally unaccustomed to this kind of illumination. So it's a struggle. But finally, he gets up to the top, sticks his head out of the cave, and for the first time in his life, he sees real things. Not cardboard cutout birds or plaster of Paris trees manufactured by the authorities, but a tree, a bird, a cloud. It's brighter than anything ever could be. I mean, he thought that fire was bright. The sun is nothing compared to that. It takes him time to become acclimatized to this kind of brightness. But eventually, he would even appreciate there's this sun, this greatest fire of all, and that it's what's illuminating all these things. Now, of course, this slave, having struggled for who knows how long to overcome all kinds of internal resistances and fears, to make it that far, the slave thinks that he's been greatly illuminated. He really thinks that he now understands something totally unique that he had no clue about his whole life. And he knows that all those other slaves down there, they don't know about this either. So he says, what I'm going to do then is I'll go back down and tell them the good news. Maybe lead a revolt. Maybe we'll have a revolution. So he works his way back down. Of course, that's almost as hard as getting back up because now he can hardly see anything. His eyes are damaged by the sun. He finally gets down there, starts trying to talk to his former friends, and he starts explaining to them, well, see, these shadows, you know, they're not real. They're just projections, artificial things. And behind us, there's this source of light. And really, it's these masters, all this stuff we thought we knew, that's just all these things that the masters have contrived for us to make us happy and satisfied, to make us think we know things. Now, how is this going to be received? All these slaves, here comes this man, he went away, who knows where, and now he comes back ranting and raving and saying that science isn't science, and truth isn't truth, and everything that we believe or really know is wrong. And so the slaves, they draw the obvious logical conclusion. Don't go out there. It makes you insane. It makes you crazy. And the more that this former slave insists, you don't know anything. It's not science. This isn't real. Well, eventually somebody just sticks a sock in his mouth and they lock him up. That's Plato's allegory of the cave. It's an allegory on at least three levels. There's different allegories. There's more than one meaning for this allegory. It's an allegory of the human situation. It's an allegory of philosophy and philosophical enlightenment. And it's an allegory of democracy and the plight of the democratic city. Let me say a word more about each one of these. First, about how the allegory is an analogy of the human situation. That's what he's saying our life is, your life is. It's like life in a cave. You're like slaves. Of course, you don't think you're slaves. Those slaves didn't think they were slaves either. And you think you know science. So did those slaves. Well, life, as it's ordinarily understood by the masses, by ordinary people who haven't experienced philosophy, it's a life of slavery and imprisonment. The world that's revealed by the senses, especially sight, it's the delusion of prisoners in a cage. The things that we think are most real, what the senses show us, what we use in everyday life, those are shadows. Pathetic, corrupted shadows of reality. When we rely on our senses and trust our sensory experience, we're like those people in a cave who confidently discuss shadows that they mistake for realities. Now, those prisoners operate in a wholly naive way. They take things one by one as they come. I mean, this shadow, then that shadow, then the next shadow, and they try to find patterns among the shadows. They have no idea that what they see are really nothing but the manufactured products of authority, rather than the real thing, nature. So that's one level at which we can read this allegory of Plato's. The second is it's also an allegory of philosophy, and of the kind of enlightenment that philosophy promises. This enlightenment is a conversion experience. A conversion means turning. You turn in philosophy. You turn your attention from down there to up there. You turn your attention from the body to the soul, from dark to light. You used to look down into the shadows. Now, with philosophy, you look up. You are converted to and converted by philosophy. Your whole life has changed. Now, Socrates, the man that we saw, for example, talking with Euthyphro, addressing the jurors of Athens, Socrates seemed to think that almost anybody, maybe even corrupt Alcibiades, almost anybody can be improved by being led to examine himself and to begin to try to think like a philosopher. Socrates, his whole life, is out in the streets, talking to anybody who comes by. Socrates' thought seems to be that talk, intellectual engagement by itself, has a power to improve people and maybe even make them good. Plato, now once Athens kills Socrates, kills his teacher, kills the wisest man he ever knew, Plato withdraws that optimistic view. Plato doesn't walk around the gym and talk to anybody who comes by like Socrates did. Plato doesn't hang out in the middle of the city. Plato set up a school. He called it the Academy. This is the beginning of this word. That school was set out outside the city walls of Athens. You had to leave the city, symbolically, to leave that mob that killed Socrates, leave their democracy and their opinions, leave all that behind. Come to this quiet, sheltered, private place where not just anybody can walk in. Now you gotta get admission. You gotta belong to a circle of the ultra elite. And there you'll be able to listen to Plato talk and read Plato's dialogue, and talk with other students who are sharing your experience of philosophy. But for Plato, knowledge by itself is inadequate to motivate the good. Knowledge isn't going to sink in and become a motive without an intellectual preparation required to understand it. Before you can profitably begin to study philosophy, the rational and the passionate parts of your soul have to be brought into harmony. Philosophy doesn't do that for you. He's not on Plato's thought. Philosophy won't harmonize the passionate and the rational parts. You have to be trained, and that's the first work of education, the preliminary to philosophy. A preparation of a philosopher begins at birth. Are you born with a good memory? Are you clever? Are you a fast learner? If not, you'll have no success in philosophy. You also need an early education, especially in mathematics. Mathematics is the best, maybe even the only way to instruct us in what it is to really know the truth. So that's the second level, which we can read Plato's allegory. What that slave did who escaped, he's like someone who gets the idea that there could be more. Remember that theme in Symposium, that there could be more. There's a light. It's dim. I don't see it. I don't know what's up there, but I know there's more. There's more than this cave. And you crawl out. That's what it's like to make the decision to commit to a course of philosophical study, to make yourself into a philosopher. A third, last level, which we can think about this allegory of the cave, only an elite can receive what Platonic philosophy promises. Most of the citizens of a democracy are excluded from philosophy and don't care. So that brings me to this third dimension of Plato's allegory. The story is also an allegory of democracy. The cave represents the democratic city. For Plato, philosophical enlightenment should make us hate democracy. Democracy is a breeding ground of opinion. There's never been so much opinion in the world since there have been democracies. The more opinion, the less that is decided by wise knowledge. The cave is just the extreme of that, where the opinionated slaves consider the one person among them who actually knows the truth to be a dangerous lunatic. The prisoners in the cave are the citizens in a democracy. Opinion is the very chain that keeps them servile. People in a democracy are saturated with opinion. Opinion flourishes in the democratic city like flowers in the sunshine. And the more opinion, the less knowledge, and the less philosophy. To overcome the causes of disorder in the political body, in the city, in the polis, in the state, or in the individual, to overcome the sources of disorder in our political body or in our own individual lives, we have to unite philosophy and political power. And in that implication, we could unite philosophy with political authority. We see the ground for Plato's optimism and his pessimism. Optimism and pessimism. First, his pessimism. Why is Plato pessimistic? Because people are sunk in error, addicted to opinion, and democracy is hopeless. Democracy is the political expression of minds that are ruled by opinion, bereft of true knowledge. That makes him pessimistic. But there's also in Plato's philosophy a reason to be optimistic, to think that maybe things could be different. After all, the idea of the good is the transcendent cause of everything real. All of nature is a cosmos that's organized by goodness, by intelligibility, by the very cause that makes things amenable to being truly understood. By grasping that idea of the good, we understand the world that we live in, and by understanding that, we will understand how best to live our life. And Plato says we can understand it. That idea of the good, or at least some of us can understand that. They will be the philosophers, the masters of the dialectic, and they, by all rights, should govern all the others. Plato takes up that idea that we first saw back when we were talking about the pre-Socratics, and I mentioned Pythagoras, that idea that the destiny of the individual human being, of the individual human soul, that it has a destiny to become as godlike as possible. That there's something divine in us, separate from our body, a different entity that is paradoxically entwined with this body, but aching for liberation, aching for enlightenment. It's divine. The best sort of person, the ideal human being, will be as close to the divine as it's possible for a mortal to be. Well, not only did Plato promote this spiritual aspiration, trying to concentrate on that divine part of yourself, that spiritual part of you, try to grow it, cultivate it. Not only did he promote this spiritual aspiration, he also made rationality the primary attribute of the divine. Now, this is really an amazing step. If you think about things before Plato, you ask any Greek, you know, what are the gods like? Well, they'll tell you. They learn about gods. That's from Homer. From Homer, we learn about Zeus, you know, zapping people with thunderbolts. We learn about Athena going in and helping all her friends win the races. We learn about the gods arguing and fighting among themselves, cheating on each other's spouses, starting wars among the human beings just to see what happens. Plato says, gods are not like that. Gods are wise and good and moral and rational. They're separated from us by immortality, but they are linked to us by what they share with us, this power of logos, of rational understanding. And therefore, Plato says, everything that the poets have said, all those famous masters of our tradition, the poets, Homer, Hesiod, the others, everything those poets told us about the gods is deeply, and to Plato, even offensively wrong. The poets are shameless liars, and they really should be suppressed. The promise of Plato's philosophy is that there's a way to pass from the perfection of to pass from ordinary life to that perfection of rationality. And then to pass from that perfection of rationality, when you work on yourself, commit to philosophy, to pass from that to divine immortality. Remember, Plato made Socrates say back in the Phaedo, we talked about last time, Socrates said that philosophy is a preparation for death. Well, what Plato was adding is that it's not only a preparation for death, but it's a preparation for what comes after death, which is the life of a god. If we want to be gods, first we have to become philosophers and rule everybody else. Remember, for Thursday, I'm going to start talking about a new author, Aristotle, a reading we have from the Metaphysics, the first writing assignment is up on the Avenue page. Please don't get